Looking for something to do after Halloween is over? Are you into the strange, bizarre, and unusual? On November 3rd, 4th, and 5th, the Strange Realities Conference is coming back to Nashville, Tennessee, and streaming online. Come join us for 3 days exploring mysteries, supernatural, the occult, weird history, and more, featuring lectures, presentations, and workshops by Tim Banal, Zach Hunt, Cheslin Vance, Bryn Collier, Tobias Whalen, Brent Rains, Joshua Kutchin, Kiki Dombrowski, Recluse, Nathan Isaac, Christopher Ernst, Aaron Gullius, David Metcalf, Timothy Renner, Mallory Sawinski, Soraya Azcap, and special guest Steve Berg as your Master of Ceremonies. Make sure to join us for the fun and informative weekend online and at SIR Nashville November 3rd and 4th, and online only November 5th. Tickets are available at strangerealitiesconference.com.
The intensity of that gets me every single time. And you know, I noticed listening to the actual audio version of this, which is
it's not in there.
So there's me remarking on the existence of the countdown, and then no one realizing exactly what the hell am I talking about. But yes, if you're hearing these, you watch these live, you can see this amazing countdown that StreamYard provides. And that is so intense and just gets everybody started. So welcome everybody to part three of our Strange Realities Conference previews on Conspiranormal. And we have another set of speakers tonight that are going to be speaking at the Strange Realities Conference. As you can find the tickets at strangerealitiesconference.com. Several online tickets are available, and also in-person tickets are available if you are in Nashville or anywhere around in surrounding states. So come see us. But we have an all-star cast tonight. So from my perspective, I will introduce each one. Cheslin Vance.
Hello, my name is Cheslin Vance. I'm a hypnotherapist. At the presentation, I'll be answering a few questions about hypnotherapy, saying exactly what it is, and then we'll go through an actual hypnosis. I'll take you through a journey, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Okay. Wow. Well, we'll talk a little bit. We'll maybe get a little more detail. We'll talk a little bit more about it. Brent Rains.
Hey, I edit Alternate Perceptions Online magazine. Started back in 1985, dealing with all sorts of anomalous phenomena. UFOs, cryptids, paranormal, lots of things following the umbrella of the paranormal. But I got interested as a ufologist at age 14 back in January of 1967. And it was pretty soon that I ran into John Keel and started reading Jacques Vallée, and I haven't been the same since. And so I drifted from nuts and bolts type ET thinking to who the hell knows? it's fascinating and very, it's just, I think the high strange stuff, the stuff that doesn't seem to fit, that a lot of people have ignored, needs to be studied. So that's what I want to kind of delve into.
Awesome. Right. And we were just talking about how you were present at the very first Strange Realities.
I was there 2019. You allowed me to have a table, and I went ahead and sold some copies of my John Keel book that had just come out in July of that year and is available on Amazon. So I appreciate that.
I should say that in 2019, Brent had hit me up about speaking, and I'd already had it all, scheduled and everything. But I said, well, I would love to have you there. And I saw that Brent, had the book about John Keel, which was really awesome. And
like get closer to Mike.
Really great book.
Well, it certainly, he inspired my journey to a great extent. So I decided to do the book.
All right. And Steven Snyder is also with us as well from the Farm Podcast.
So, like, I took a heroic dose of mushrooms when I was 19 at the University of Colorado Springs. I saw 7-foot aliens, gray aliens, and hallucination, and I've never been the same since. I now wander the earth looking for all kinds of strange stuff and parapolitical intrigues to study and follow.
All right.
Yes, and also host the great podcast The Farm.
Yep, and guys, several fascinating books, and also a Strange Realities vet who's been at every one since 2019 as well, I believe.
Actually, I think 2020 was my first rodeo.
Yeah, everyone since besides 2019. So we had a very limited lineup in 2019, but it was our first rodeo.
Yep. And I should say, Brent, we didn't have you last year, but we're rectifying that this year.
So I appreciate it.
We are very happy to have you. You know, we have a newbie to Strange Realities this year. We have Cheslin here. And Cheslin, we were kind of just talking a little bit about it when you introduced yourself, but can you tell us a little more about what you're going to do in your presentation and kind of like your background with studying hypnosis and hypnotherapy?
Absolutely. During the presentation, as I said, I'll be answering questions for like a few minutes. But after that, we'll get into the meat of it, and I'll take anyone who's interested on a collective group hypnosis. It sounds scary. It's not, I promise. It's very relaxing. It's very calming. If anyone here is into meditation, it's a little bit like that. A lot of people say that the hypnotic state is like the sister to the meditative state. So what I'll do is I'll induce the crowd into hypnosis. And then based on what we talked about or the vibe of the crowd, I'll just kind of take you on a little bit of a journey and just show you what kind of things you can experience under hypnosis. A lot of people can actually feel certain feelings. A lot of people can see certain scenes. It'll be very, very fun, very PG, you know? Yeah, we'll just what you can expect if you're there, is to just what it would be like to be in a hypnotherapy or just a regular hypnosis session with myself.
Awesome. We always like to have some kind of experiential thing, and that'll be bringing something we've never done before to Strange Realities. Brent, you did some stuff a while back with those Peruvian flutes, I remember, that kind of put me in a hypnotic state. So
Yeah, they were, down in South America. I think they started in Ecuador and then moved down into Peru. And it went on for about 2,500 years, presumably, and until the Spanish arrived. And, of course, they were seen as, the work of the devil and such. They had various, they were often, wish I had one with me, but you know what they look like. But they're, clay vessels that they made. And they had, they were effigy vessels. They showed different, beings, maybe a holy man, like in a meditative state, or maybe animals, or even somewhere people were engaged in sexual acts, which of course the Spanish thought was definitely the devil there. But yeah, they put a stop to it. But a lot of the people wasn't just the priesthood or the shamanic people of Peru. Men, women, children of all classes were buried with these things, and so they were. They were quite, used by everybody, and people have found that when blown, they create a kind of an altered state. And I've had a lot of people tell me, I've done some workshops, and particularly for the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the Edgar Casey Foundation, and I had some pretty phenomenal stories. People even saying they left their bodies during it. But you remember what your experience was like? I never actually talked with you about it.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember too. That was a few years ago. I remember kind of like the tingling sensations. I think it was more than anything. Mm-hmm. And so there was two, right? Like one on each side, and they kind of create a binaural.
Yeah. Like, yeah, kind of a binaural beat, kind of like with the Monroe Institute, because that uses it for people to go into meditative states and kind of journey and maybe even out of the body. So, we've had reports of that, or visionary, powerful visionary state, but mostly just if we can just, accomplish having people in a very relaxed state, it's we've accomplished something there. It's positive.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really looking forward to the hypnosis session. Mm-hmm. And, we always want to have something like that at the Strange Realities events. Of course, for anyone who wants to participate, it is optional, but come get hypnotized at Strange Realities.
Yeah, you should. I mean, what better way to start the day than being hypnotized?
And what time will that be, Adam?
Yeah, well, the reason I say that, so Cheslin is starting us off on Saturday, November the 4th. This is from 9:30 to 10:30, and that's going to be Cheslin's presentation / workshop on hypnosis.
It's going to be rad.
Looking forward to that.
Are you going to make anybody like cluck like a chicken or anything like that? Or
I don't really do that, as that can happen.
There will be voluntary guinea pigs. I'm sure, whatever you want to do.
I mean, whoever's interested, like.
do you think is there a better time? I mean, this. Because as I was doing the schedule, I was like, man, I don't know if I want to hypnotize everybody at the beginning of the morning. But is there a better time to do hypnosis during the day?
Good question. The most ideal time to do hypnosis is right before bed, because it makes you very, very sleepy when you come out of it. That's a really good indication of how deep into hypnosis you went, is how sleepy you are when you're like 1, 2, 3, eyes open, wide awake. So at the end of the day is usually the best time, but there's really any time of day is good, because it's depending on like what journey you go on. It's going to put you in a good mood. So, I believe you asked a few minutes ago, Adam, my background. I'll tell you a little bit about that, if that's cool.
Yeah, please. Yep. Absolutely.
So I went to HMI, Hypnotherapy Motivational Institute. It's the first and only accredited hypnotherapy college in the U.S. It's been around for, I think it was founded in like the 50s. It's been around for forever. It used to be only in California, but then 2020 happened. And so they branched off to online, and I was able to enroll, and it was 13 wonderful months of, because it's hypnotherapy, right? So it was like 13 wonderful months of like therapy and like learning about the mind, learning about the subconscious mind, and like therapeutic modalities to like help get through traumas. It was really wonderful. Like, it was one of the best 13 months of my life. And I bring that up now to say that many of my mentors would say that hypnotherapy is like best to do in the early mornings, like we're doing, and then super, like, really, really good at night, because your mind. Like, in order for you to fall asleep, you kind of have to go through hypnosis, and then you're asleep. So when you're waking up and when you're falling asleep, you're kind of even more susceptible to that, and you're like kind of already there. So like 10:30, although it's not super early, although most people aren't like Just waking up. It's a really good time.
Probably for some of these people, so.
I don't know.
Probably just be waking up.
Hey, no judgment. No judgment. Yeah. We all have late days.
They'll probably get started Friday night after the first night, and they'll probably just be waking up. So hopefully they can have some kind of remnant of that hypnagogic state, and will help with the hypnosis.
There you go.
Well, you know, I should say, too, that if anyone wants to see you in action, like your technique, we did do on Nevaeh's Nightmare. We did do where you did a past life regression on Nevaeh.
Yeah, we sure
that
did.
That is out there on her channel. So
that was a really interesting video.
Yeah, how did you feel about that, doing that?
I loved it. I thought it was really cool. Whenever I'm doing past life regression or a hypnosis that involves the client speaking, I'm not as in control, I should say, because I don't know what they're gonna say. I don't know what they're thinking. Like when it's just me speaking, like I'm telling the story. I'm taking you through. I'm guiding you through like what's happening. But when it's a back and forth, like you're putting your input, I'm putting my input, and like we create something together. So whenever it's with a client who's also speaking, like I really enjoy it because it's a co-creation. It's a co-creation. We're creating the story together, and we're changing like the subconscious mind together. And it's always better to change the subconscious mind when your own conscious mind is on board with it. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like, if your ego agrees, like the rest of you is gonna follow. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but
yeah.
But I don't know. I really enjoyed it, and I'd love to do it again.
Yeah, I have a question for you on that. Like when we did that, do you see like the past life regression? Do you think that they're actually remembering a past life, or is it more useful as like a form of therapy?
That is an awesome question.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of back and forth debates on that. There's a lot of people that believe that they're actually going into their past lives. And then there's, you know, the other side that thinks, no, it's just in their imagination. And really there's no real way to say. Personally, I believe what happens in the client's subconscious mind is what's supposed to happen. So if they're actually accessing like memories of a different life, which I don't think that's impossible at all. I think that's very possible. Like if they're actually accessing memories from a different life, then that was what was supposed to happen. And they can heal those memories in this life because they're not as attached to it. Mm-hmm. But if it's something made up in their mind, then that was also what was supposed to happen. And maybe they're just not in the place yet to access that past life, or maybe their past life is already like they already took like they already completed whatever needed to be completed. So my personal opinion is yes, it can happen. I mean, yes, many do. And then there are some that is completely made up, which is also fine. Like I had a fellow, not a client, but my fellow student. I put her through a past life regression. Excuse me. I put her through a past life regression, and she was saying that she went back in time, and it was completely historically inaccurate, like 100%. But it was exactly what needed to happen to her. Like she was saying that she was like Queen Elizabeth, and she was like visited by like beings that weren't documented in that time, let's just say. There's no like documentation for that, but I don't think that that's necessarily, I don't think that's necessarily like the point of a past life regression. You know what I'm saying?
What kind of beings can I ask?
She was just saying, well, she's not a client, so it's okay for me to say. She was just saying, like, she saw her. I'll just have to.
You can tell me here.
I don't know if I want to share. She didn't really give me permission to share.
Okay. But, we'll keep it there.
We
can keep it there then. That's fine.
We can keep it like this. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us when we're off the.
If you're interested.
That's why you want to go to Strange Realities.
Exactly.
The real scoop.
Awesome. So,
and you're in Nashville, so it's great to have more local folks.
Yes. Born and raised in Nashville.
Right.
That's even better, even though I'm not in Nashville anymore, but we always tried to have some kind of connections. Brand is in the area as well.
Awesome.
And
Waynesboro, 90 miles south. But you know, on the subject of hypnosis, I remember Dr. Arlio Sprinkle, who was involved in hypnosis with a lot of UFO experiences, but also reincarnation. And he made the point that that the hypnosis that he used often was much more effective in dealing with getting people on a better track in their life, no matter what. Whether it was real or unreal, than regular psychotherapeutic sessions. And there was another doctor, I remember, that arrived at the same conclusion, who also used hypnosis. So I thought that was interesting finding. Whether it was fantasy or whatever, it kind of gave them things that stimulated them to make changes in their life that was constructive, or useful to them.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, I think in the long run, I think it's like, it's an altered state of consciousness, just like any other. And I think that there is, just like with say an hallucinogenic drugs, I mean, there can be a therapeutic aspect to it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to let the people know, hypnosis is safe. Hypnotherapy is safe. You can create a very safe environment, but with hallucinogenic drugs, you can have an amazing, wonderful trip that opens your mind and just helps you elevate in a way. But then you can also have a really dark trip that shows you scary things. I think both at the end of the day will help you, but hypnosis can be a really unpleasant experience with the wrong guidance, I'll say.
So, yeah.
It usually is amazing. 99 times out of 100, it's great. But there's a possibility for one time. That's not going to happen with me, though.
Right. The one of Strange Realities will be very positive for everybody.
It's going to be amazing.
Yes. So, Brent, you actually, everybody here actually speaking on Saturday. Brent, you are speaking on Saturday right after Cheslin. So that means everyone's going to be hypnotized for your talk.
Oh, good.
So
everybody buys books.
It should go good.
I've not talked to you about this, and I am very curious to see what you're going to be speaking about at Strange Realities.
Well, I'm going to be talking about something that many of the mainstream ufologists haven't usually, talked that much about. It's the high strange aspects, as Hynek toward the end called them. Dr. Jalen Hynek, who was the astronomical consultant for the Air Force Project Blue Book and such for many years. And there were cases that just, you wonder what is going on. They don't fit the general profile of what a lot of people for years in ufology thought should be happening. And there was a time when one of the major organizations, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was founded in 1956 by a former Marine Major Donald E. Kehoe, that they just wanted reports of craft, all this other stuff. They thought, you know, if somebody saw an alien or the craft landed, ignore that report. They pick and choose what they wanted. And they wanted very credible observations of craft coming down. And the other stuff just got too woo-woo, you know, like George Adamski, visitors from Venus, whatever. So they ignored a lot of evidence. And even Dr. Hynek, you know, was kind of affected by that for a long time. And until meeting Jacques Vallée, the, you know, the astronomer, mathematician from France in 1963. And he told them about the landing cases and occupant cases they had in a wave back in France in 1954. And that there was, you know, there were some good investigations done, and it was pretty anomalous stuff. And Hynek always, at that up until that point, kept expressing that there was these events were probably just, as the Air Force was saying, just teenagers, you know, with a gas can making a fire on the ground. And then he started looking into it a little further. And in 1964, he investigated the Lonnie Zamoro case out in New Mexico, Saco, New Mexico, the parent craft taking off with two occupants nearby. So, you know, he slowly began to look into these elements and come up with close encounters, the first and second and third kind, and then eventually the high strange, and where you don't know exactly what exactly is going on. You have occupants, and then you have the real high strange cases where they go through walls and levitate people and take them aboard the craft and do examinations and all that. And, you know, the kind of stories that some people don't want to deal with, poltergeist activity erupting in their home right after a UFO event. Usually investigators have in the past, when they go to a home, and if they were, you know, considered credible mainstream, they would just interview the person about maybe the story that appeared in the newspaper or the sighting that they wrote them about. They wouldn't ask, have you ever had any other unusual, unexplained experiences, and just leave it open like that. And then they would maybe, as in 2019, when I attended your conference, Tim Renner and Joshua Cutchin, they delved into that. There was the women in white and all these other anomalous things that, you know, they would ask a witness, maybe saw Bigfoot. Well, anything else unusual happened? And I remember the one case, you know, where the guy said, well, my house was haunted, and he had some pictures, and he looked at the, Tim Renner looked at the pictures, and the guy thought they looked like a motorcycle gang, and Tim Renner looked at it and said they looked more like Bigfoot, you know? And then there was a picture or something to see with a woman in a mirror, a woman dressed in white, and then he came across more cases like that. And that rung a bell with me, and I come back home, started digging through my files, and thought, damn, you know, I've I've had some of this sitting in my files from some years back, and I need to pay more attention to that. And so, but a lot of people, if you, a lot of ufologists, they go and interview someone, and then they say, well, last week I saw a Bigfoot run across the yard. You'll be like, well, no, that's not my department. You need to talk to one of those cryptozoologists or somebody. Yeah. A poltergeist just talked to us. Ghost hunter, you know. But anyway.
Right. The different sections of the paranormal, and like none of them ever communicate and talk to each other. And
but, you know, now we're hearing more and more about people going to what have been called window areas where there's a lot of activity, and investigators like Ted Phillips.
Right.
You know, he said he was a nuts and bolts guy, and then he investigated the areas he calls Marley Woods in Missouri. And he experienced things firsthand himself, got pictures of these lights. He's passed on because he worked with Dr. Hynek. He was the guy that went out and investigated landing sites. And they had some extremely high strange things. And he got to witness it. And he said he went from being nuts and bolts guy to just the nuts guy now, you know. And so that was Marley Woods. And then there's, you know, places out in Sedona and Bradshaw Ranch out in Arizona, you know, the Sedona area of Arizona. And in my current issue, the October issue of Alternate Perceptions, I've got things in my reality checking column about Ben Lone Tree, Benjamin Lone Tree, who's an electronics technician, engineer who is retired now, but he's got all this equipment. He goes out and measures energy ground readings and such out there and around Sedona and Bradshaw Ranch, and they're off the charts and very unusual readings. And this is where a lot of these high strange things are happening. And also, I've been in touch with a Jeremiah Hartzman, who is describing some very strange things that have gone on just in recent weeks out there, and lots of witnesses. So, and that's just another location, San Luis Valley, Colorado. We've been talking with Christopher O'Brien, who's written a number of books on the anomalies, the UFOs, the cryptids, cattle mutilations, and so forth. So. That's something I want to talk about is, you know, it's these investigators are doing a big turnaround on this and being out in the field and boots on the ground in the trenches and you know, not only getting the reports, but also being out in the field and experiencing things themselves. And it changes the narrative. And that was what intrigued me, of course, years ago when Kiel was reporting these things. And it took a while for people to get on board and more of the researchers to get out in the field and actually delve into this themselves. So,
cool. Well,
a question for you.
Go ahead. I got a question
for you, Brent. You've been doing this for a long, long time. I mean, you started, doing this kind of like investigative work and correspondences with other investigators. I mean, since you were like a teenager, basically, right?
Yeah, since age 14. It's January. It'll be 57 years.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you really are someone that has put the work in, and these high strange aspects. I mean, how much of this of those aspects of these cases did you encounter when you were first looking into all this stuff back in like the 60s or 70s?
The 70s, I actually was in 69. I was actually, as a teenager, I was on the board of directors of a magazine down in St. Petersburg, Florida, called Saucer Scoop. And it was pretty well known at the time. And John Whitnor was the editor and publisher, and Brad Steiger was, I think, public relations guy, and Joan and Brad Steiger became quite well known for writing books and articles together, and they were also receiving articles from John Kiel. And so in October 1969, I began to engage Kiel before he even came out with the books on UFOs, like, you know, the Mothman Prophecies and Strange Creatures from Time and Space and so on. And so I got kind of a head start there, and we corresponded. And he had a non-scheduled newsletter called Anomaly. I had my teenage UFO publication mimeographed called Scientific Saucer-itis Review. Saucer-itis is like it's a disease of some kind, because I had seen, I think, in news clippings from 1947 where some psychologist said it's like a mind disease with these people. I call it saucer-itis. So I thought, okay, that's one way I call my magazine. But, I was starting to get into the high strains then. At first, I had read Frank Edwards' Flying Saucer Serious Business, and that was definitely a mainstream nuts and bolts ET direction it was taken. And I was hesitant at first, but in beginning in 1975, I spent just about the whole summer on the road going from Maine, where I lived at the time, down to Florida, you know, Indiana and Ohio and Connecticut and Pennsylvania, Tennessee, where I eventually ended up at. And I did that for about 3 years until I got married, and then I had to cool my heels, you know, because it was costing money. But I really enjoyed it, and I investigated people reporting Bigfoot. And I went to West Virginia, talked with some of the people there on Mothman, and I've been, you know, of course, with Kiel, you know, the interest I had in his work, naturally, I'd end up there at some point. And just, you know, UFO contact. I've been very involved in talking with people and their stories. And again, there's always a lot of this stuff. If you really pursue it, you find that the people who have reported, you know, their reports are online or they're in a book or something or a magazine where they've seen something and it moves on to another story. But there are thousands of reports worldwide, and you read just the general, so-and-so said they saw a craft land and a being got out. And you wonder what else has happened to them, you know? And that's an important area just to give them, you know, and Tim Runner and Joshua Cutchin, I know they do that. They ask, you know, as gently as possible, what other unusual things have you had experiences with? And,
right.
And so I was in 73. I remember I was with a woman quite well known in the field who was also an experiencer herself. And we interviewed someone and she brought up that question. And the lady at first had seen a saucer two nights in a row down near a Naval Air Base in Jacksonville, Florida. And she asked the question, what else unusual have you had experience in your life? And she said, no, nothing. And then she said, well, one time a friend had died, and then I got a phone call. It sounded just like that person. They said they were going to come to the house. I started crying, and I said, no, don't come. And then she said, oh, yeah, and there was a time I saw an apparition of a person. And you know, and gradually she started remembering things that she had just, you know, didn't really have a context for and just kind of pushed it back in her mind. So that was a good approach. It was a good learning curve for me on that.
Yeah, I mean, you have been doing this for a very long time, and one of the really cool moments for me in 2021 was getting you and Alan Greenfield together. And I think that Alan had said that he had not seen you for like 40 years or something like that.
Yeah, I didn't know if you even remembered meeting me, but it was around 1977 at a conference he was speaking at in Ohio. And, you know, he had a book just came out called Saucers and Sorcerers. And then later a group of us in Ohio, which I was hanging out with a lot of people from the Cincinnati area. And we traveled up to, I guess maybe it was Cleveland, and they had a conference, that was part Star Trek and part UFO. And, so anyway, Gene Steinberg was there, and of course Al Greenfield, and those are the only two I remember. But we got to talk with Alan Greenfield later up at his room, a bunch of us, and just sit around and ask him questions, and hadn't seen him since then.
So, was he kind of wild back then?
well he's wilder now, I think.
Steven, you were going to ask a question.
Yeah, Brent. Well, actually, I had two questions. Like, the crowd you were talking about in Cincinnati, were any of those like part of the Bait Cabal? Or what was it, the Horse Mat Lodge that came after it? They were sort of like a magical group that was active in the Cincinnati area around that time?
No, actually, it was Charles and Jerry Wilhelm of the Ohio UFO Skywatchers and Investigators League. And they had a publication called the Ohio Skywatcher. And so I had spent a lot of time with them because they'd investigating like the 1973 flap a lot. And I'd been recommended to go see them. So I flew out there in June and spent a week. And they invited me to come back and use their home as a base of operations, which was really, really awesome. It was actually Dr. Berthold Schwartz, a psychiatrist at the time living in Montclair, New Jersey. And as I traveled around the country, he was telling me places I should go and check out while I was doing this. He was actually someone that John Keel had introduced to the UFO field, pretty much. He had written an article in a medical journal on UFO sightings that he had investigated, but he was mainly a parapsychologist. And John Keel introduced him to a number of people in the field, like Charles Bowen, the editor of England's Flying Saucer Review, which he began writing articles for. And Dr. Schwartz was so inspired, he began, you know, go to UFO meetings and doing conferences, doing talks, and going traveling to meet people and investigating the phenomena himself. And so I made his acquaintance again through that lady in Florida who was an experiencer. And we exchanged correspondence going from 1973 till his passing in 2010. So I got a lot of perspective on how a psychiatrist slash parapsychologist looks at UFO phenomena. And he covered everything as well, you know, all the high strange. And a lot of it, I think, he thought was definitely important, psychic, a lot of it projection from her own unconscious. But he still found it extremely interesting. And he thought that some things like EVPs and actually photographic evidence, he studied a lady in Massachusetts named Stella Lansing. He went out in the field with her and saw some strange lights. And right off the bat, he thought that this is very important. She got these anomalies on film. Now, I went down and I met her again through Dr. Swartz. And she had a thing called clockwork that D. Scott Rogo and Brad Steiger and others put in their books. But I had written Kodak, and you know, at first I said, maybe it's static electricity. Maybe it's a lens flare. No, that didn't fit. The images looking like luminous dials of a clock would appear on the film and often overlap frames. And you know, Dr. Swartz went to photographers and they were mystified. And so anyway, I kept writing Kodak. Kodak, finally, there was a technician there who wrote and says, I have the answer. It's rivets. You would take a 50-foot length of Super 8 millimeter film. You attach it on one end and another on the other end and run it through a vat of developing fluid with a bunch of other film strips at the same time. And this vat will develop, you know, as part of the development process. And they stopped using the rivet, so I never got a rivet. But I had my own footage where I got clockwork, so-called, on my own film. And I could take it, and it would only be on one side. And again, it would overlap frames, and I would hold it in a light, a lamp overhead. And you could see that it was impressed. It wasn't really a photographic image. It was actually imprinted into the film. And so I made Dr. Swartz aware of it. He said, well, that may be, but sometimes it gets in the middle of the film, according to Stella. And I thought, maybe sometimes it's a fluke, but by and large. And so I tried to express that I really think, you know, and so we had a disagreement on that. But right. And Stella called me up, and when he told her what I had found, and she said, Brent, if you'd wanted to know what this was, I had contacted Kodak too. And, you know, this is, I don't believe that answer. And I thought, well, I do. So anyway, I had to calm her down. But so, you know, I know there's something to some of these instances where certain people get unusual images. But I think in that case, the clockwork one, I have an explanation for. It just, you know.
And you said the Staggers are based out of St. Petersburg, Florida, or did I misunderstand that?
Oh, well, no, Brad Steiger, he's originally from Iowa, and he lived in Arizona. And
when they were doing the journal, though, I think you mentioned in the mid-60s.
Back in 69, when I was on the board representing the state of Maine, and it was... he was like public relations director, as I recall. He was listed on, you know, as a member of the board, but he was not living in Florida. He just, you know, wrote for him.
Well, do you happen to know though if the publication would have had any encounters with James Shelby Downard? Because I think he was based out of St. Petersburg around that time. Been kind of trying to put together a history of some of the groups that he might have been in contact with, and that seems like something that would be down his alley.
James Edward Downer?
Shelby Downard.
Shelby Downard.
Yeah, I've been spending time with Richard Spence lately.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I can look back in some of the back issues I have and see if anything comes up on that. But
that, well, that would be extraordinarily interesting if that was the case.
Well, yeah, because we've been trying to figure out how that circle of Fortians really hooked up with Downard in Florida during the 70s. But, I mean, it seems like that would be a logical place for them to meet him.
Was that, that was primarily a UFO publication, though, Brent?
Well, it was, but no, I mean, you had John Keel writing articles.
Yeah, I mean, if John Keel, you would definitely have Fortean's work lurking in the background somewhere.
Yeah, there were some, a lot of very strange stories, yeah.
Just the most,
the
most paranoid, raving, lunatic writing that was in it might be this guy that Recluse is looking for, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know him, but anyway, probably glad to look in what I have and see if the...
Well, if you're oh, on
thank the, you, Brent, and I know Richard would thank you as well.
if Brent, I think you may be a member of the 2022 streaming group from last year. So if you go back and watch Adam Go Rightly's presentation, you'll learn all about James Shelby Downard.
Okay,
because that's primarily what he did it on. So we should say, Brent, you are speaking at 10:40 a.m. to 11:40 a.m. on Saturday morning.
Keep in mind,
guys, for everybody listening that is listening on this or the podcast version, that is Central Time. So you may have a hypnotized audience, but maybe you can get some suggestions put in there.
And well, Brent, you know, it'd be good.
Brent should have his books available. And last year had some back issues of alternate perceptions and UFO perceptions for collectors of ephemera.
Yeah, I've still got quite a few of those.
And, bring them out, and everyone should buy them up.
Sounds good.
Okay. Steven, you've got quite the presentation for us this year.
Yeah, well, here's hoping. it sort of had a bit of a genesis in the book that I just released, The Art, The Secret History of Cyborg and Spiritainment and the Shattering Reality, Book 1. It's been quite an endeavor writing this thing. It took me roughly 3.5 years. Took me basically across the entire country to San Francisco, the barracks in Carlisle, just all kinds of other archives. And originally it was going to be one book, and then I think around the 200,000 word mark, it came to a realization I was going to have to rethink that prospect. So anyway, finally got the first book out. But as to the presentation, I want to say about 2021, 2022, I was contacted by Jason Horsley, former host of Audit Culture. And of course, he's written The Vice of Kings, a lot of other fantastic books. And he was doing some work on artificial intelligence, predictive modeling, and all this kind of stuff, which had become a major point of emphasis in my book when I had started to research Cambridge Analytica. And one of the really striking things that I had found was that this kind of technology that was based around data mining and predictive modeling that could be applied to elections was actually pioneered by a company named Simulmatics, and that the first election it was used in was in 1960 by none other than John F. Kennedy. So the stuff had actually been around for a good 60 years or so, I mean, even before the Cambridge Analytica scandal. But as I started to look into this, it became really interesting because one of the guys involved with Simulmatics in the early years was a guy called Eugene Burdick, I believe, who ended up writing a couple of novels as well. In fact, he was a bit of a jack of all trades, did all kinds of cool stuff, quote unquote. But one of his books was The Ugly American, which of course later became a major bestseller. And then he wrote a book called Failsafe, which has a plot remarkably similar to a movie called Dr. Strangelove.
Right.
And in fact, it was in development at the same time that Stanley Kubrick was developing Dr. Strangelove, and the plot was actually so similar that Kubrick decided to sue Burdick to try to prevent the production of his adaptation so that Strangelove would come out first. So anyway, I get into talking to Jason about this, and I mention how I thought that later Kubrick would get into some of the Simulmatics stuff in his movies, especially in 2001. I really think that how was actually modeled in that whole sort of process of predictive modeling with personality profiles. Basically, I don't think Hal malfunctioned. I think that he did a personality profile on the astronauts to ascertain whether or not they had the mental fortitude to deal with what was coming, said that they didn't, and he acted accordingly. So Jason, I guess, was pretty spurred by that, but he had already been thinking about a Kubrick book. So that sort of laid the genesis for what became KubrickCon, this excellent book that he just released this year. Also, it ended up having some of the first bit of the research that I had done in Simulmatics too, so that was really cool. But anyway, if you haven't read a lot of Jason's stuff on Kubrick, Jason hates Stanley Kubrick with an absolute passion.
Really?
Conversely, Stanley Kubrick is my all-time favorite filmmaker. For me, basically, there's Stanley Kubrick, there's David Lynch, and there's pretty much everybody else as far as directors go, except for maybe John Carpenter, okay? But, and ironically, Jason is a big David Lynch fan. I don't really get how you could hate Kubrick and love David
Lynch. So he wrote a whole book about Kubrick, but he hates Kubrick.
Yes, he hates Kubrick, but he wrote a whole book about him. Interesting. Wanted to get into all of the deep state implications and stuff like that. And Kubrick, he was using some of the research I had done along with a lot of the other research as a basis for this. So
is this some of the like the eyes wide shut stuff.
Mm-hmm. So Jason does his whole thing on Kubrick. And I mean, you know, I just can't let that sit, right? Because I mean, this is my boy, Stanley Kubrick. So I got to do some kind of response for this. So I'd already been toying with the notion of doing a big presentation on Kubrick, I think as far back as the summer, because I wanted basically an excuse to get in here and debate Jason, which I actually just did yesterday. And for round one in the great Kubrick debate, I think I pulled it off, boys. But anyway.
The pro Kubrick won, huh?
Yeah. It's been long gestating, but I put together a huge presentation on Kubrick. In fact, I actually have had to divide it into two because otherwise I would probably be talking for 3 hours if I tried to cover Kubrick's entire career. But essentially, I was going to go in and look at a lot of the more conspiratorial allegations with Kubrick and ascertain what we could legitimately say were his connections to the National Security Services, what were maybe some of the surprising things they were doing in that regard, and it's not really explicitly stated, to basically debunk the whole thing about the faking the moon landing stuff and what have you, because that's just ridiculous in a lot of levels. And frankly, it covers up for a lot of really interesting stuff about Kubrick, especially what appears to be a full-blown psychological warfare campaign that the Kennedy administration had him running against the U.S. military. That is one of the things that I will be getting into, along with his likely connections to the whole mythos around the Nine, from good old Adrina Puharik's The Nine. Yes, those folks. And also its potential ties to one of the most storied and infamous murders of the 20th century that has fascinated Hollywood for decades now.
Man, well, this sounds really meaty, Stephen. I am...
All right.
I am looking forward to this. Okay.
Trust me, this is going to be Stanley Kubrick like you've never seen before. I know people heard some conspiratorial takes on this, but I'm bringing out a lot of stuff that I don't think has ever been seriously considered before.
And you're going to do it at the Strange Realities Conference.
Yes, sir. I mean, of course, up to that point, we got the great Kubrick debate with me and Jason on the farm. And then for the Zoom party I got coming up here in about a week now, I'm going to go deep dive on The Shining. But the real meat of the stuff is going to be at Strange Realities, and there are going to be some crazy revelations there.
Okay. Right. Well, I really don't want to say any more about this, because I want people to either come physically to the Strange Realities Conference, or I want them to come to the online and see this presentation. Wow. Okay.
Trust me, it's going to be groovy, guys.
This is going to be a good one. And we should tell everybody, Stephen, you are scheduled 4:30 to 5:30 Central Time. That is PM. On Saturday evening, so you are right before dinner, so plenty of time to talk about Stanley Kubrick during the dinner break, which is at SIR itself. So I would add, just to say, now, not a movie directed by Stanley Kubrick, but in 2010, they did explain why HAL killed the astronauts in 2001.
But that's a cover-up, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, definitely Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke had a lot of diverging opinions on some of the stuff that went on in the script. So, yeah. But Kubrick did not associate himself with 2010 for a variety of reasons.
Right. I mean, it's a very different movie than 2001, obviously. It was kind of Arthur C. Clarke wrote it, but the movie was it wasn't like heady and as intellectual as probably 2001 was.
I think, yeah, Arthur C. Clarke didn't work on it until a good 10 years or something too
after 2001
came out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's true too. And it may have actually happened in the early 80s. I mean, the movie was like 84.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'm thinking that it might have just been a way to kind of wrap up 2001. But he came out with another sequel, which is 2061. So there was also that as well. So, but that never got produced into a movie. Actually, then there was 3001.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't there like the 3001?
Yeah, there was a 3001 too, yeah. So I don't know whether or not, I think maybe that Clark intended 2001 as probably just like a one-off type of thing, so.
Yeah, it was, I think, only after the enormous success of the franchise that he decided to just keep expanding it effectively. But that's kind of another thing about Kubrick, too, when it's like you sort of consider some of the source material and whether or not that he actually had any intention of following through. One of the things like Jason and I were discussing in that regard, for instance, was The Shining and Kubrick's decision to do the maze at the end versus the, the hedge animals, I think, that came to life.
Yeah, that's what it is in the book.
And the official story was that Kubrick tested, like, some animatronics to try and get the hedge animals, but then after the results weren't that great, he decided to go in a completely different direction. And frankly, neither Jason and I believe that in the slightest. I think the maze was always the intent. I mean, can you even imagine Stanley Kubrick doing a freaking movie with an animatronic hedge animal tracing a kid around like a hotel? I mean, like, there's no way he was going to do that. It was not going to happen. Never.
I think one of my most interesting things about Kubrick is how he was such a prolific director up to a certain point, and then he just kind of stopped. So, like, in the 70s, he does Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, and he's only got really those two movies. And then he does The Shining, and then he does Full Metal Jacket, and then doesn't come back till Eyes Wide Shut, which is his last movie, which is released after he's dead. I've always found that interesting. Maybe that could have been for health reasons, but it seemed like that just at a certain point that he just backed away and he just kind of just did whatever project that he wanted to do. And I always thought Full Metal Jacket was an odd choice. As good a movie as it is, I always thought that was kind of an odd choice for him to do.
Well, he was actually, I think, much more keen on box offices than a lot of people realize. And when you get into like Full Metal Jacket, which was the project he started looking at in the early 1980s, this is like right around the time when, you know, like Rambo and the Missing in Action movies were really starting to make waves at the box office. So from Kubrick's thinking, it's like, okay, you've got all of these sort of cheesy Vietnam-centric action movies. So I'm Stanley Kubrick. I could come out with like my big, you know, sort of art house movie or whatever on Vietnam that'll kind of play into that market, but I mean, we'll elevate it to a higher plane or something like that. So it was a great thought, but unfortunately he was sort of upstaged by Oliver Stone when Platoon came out, and so you sort of had this serious Oscar caliber Vietnam movie that beat Full Metal Jacket to the release date, and that I think took some of the wind out of the sails of that movie. But when you sort of look at it in the context of marketing trends, as well as Kubrick's longtime fascination with warfare, it makes a lot more sense in that context that he opted to go with Vietnam. And then, you know, I also think a big part of why the Full Metal Jacket story appealed to him is because of the section in the boot camp, right? Because really, brainwashing, dehumanization, these are certainly reoccurring themes throughout. And it's not really talked about before, but there are a few organizations in the world that are better at brainwashing than the United States military, and especially the Marine Corps. And a big part of that is boot camp. So this is sort of an aspect of that that you don't really see addressed in a movie before, really, I think, since, as far as it goes with basic training. In that sense, it also, I think, makes a lot of it's very plausible in the trajectory of Kubrick's career. But the thing with Kubrick, and I think that it, you know, kind of provides some interesting insights into what else he might have been doing to supplement his income, it's just the absolute fanaticism with research, which I think is a big part of why he was bogged down with movies in the latter part of his life. Because I was reading John Fenwick's account of Kubrick's work as a producer, and this guy went to the Stanley Kubrick archives in London to go through a lot of the materials there for this book, right? So he walks into this room, and it's almost entirely filled with nothing but books. And he, you know, goes to the archivist, and he's like, oh, so this must be Stanley's private collection of books, right? Oh, no. These are just the books that he had for one project. One project? Yeah, one project. So Stanley Kubrick literally had warehouses all over Europe, all over the UK, that were filled with materials that he had collected for his movies, like his Napoleon movie that he never got made. I mean, he literally had all of these, not costumes, but actual authentic garments from the 18th century that he had bought over the years. He had all this furniture from the 18th century, in addition to just caches of books and just research material that he gathered for this, that he had to, you know, essentially rent out warehouses to store in after a while. And this is just one of his projects. And he's doing this for everything. And that's kind of where, you know, it gets really interesting when you think about Kubrick doing science fiction so much, and especially the AI movie, which he started working on in around 1970. So this is a project Kubrick was working on for nearly 30 years, and it gives him excuse to continuously consult with many of the leading scientists in the world about the future of computers, the future of artificial intelligence, of climate, all kinds of other things like that. So he's actually operating in a capacity very similar to how an intelligence analyst would be working to make futures predictions.
So it's almost like the filmmaking was secondary to these larger research projects.
Yeah, because nobody ever did research projects like this for a film like Kubrick did, certainly.
I wonder if the Ridley Scott, the Napoleon, is that, if that has anything to do with Kubrick's...
Well, I know the HBO, I don't know if that was the same one Ridley Scott was doing, but I know HBO was trying to finally do Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon as like, I think, a 7-part miniseries. I think Steven Spielberg's trying to work on this one, too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's going to be great, Steven. I'm really looking forward to that. There is, Cheslin, I've got something for you here.
Yes.
Before we stop, there was a remark question here. I don't know if you can see this, but I will read it. It says, interested to know what level of efficacy you get with conducting a hypnosis session online with a patient or client versus an in-person session, and if that separation is less conducive to inducing hypnosis or the strength of the hypnotic experience. Looks like it's about, I guess, doing it online as opposed to in person.
That's a really good question, Cole, Mark. Awesome question. Thank you for asking. Online is usually better because you're in your own home. You know, you're in your own space. You know your space. You feel safe in your space. When you go to like an office, like out of person, or like we're gonna do like a conference, you're a little bit more anxious. You're a little bit more. You're less likely to go. You're gonna go in hypnosis regardless with a good hypnotherapist, but it's gonna be a little bit more tricky because you're more guarded. But when you're at home, you're feeling safe, and like it's just easier for your body to relax into the state.
Awesome. Well, yeah, we always try to make sure that these experience and workshop-based presentations are streamable as well. But if it works even better, or potentially does, then that's really cool.
Yeah. It works perfectly if you're like listening to this like on your phone and laying in bed.
Yeah, and that's something too, guys. We'll have a lot of people in an online audience, so you guys will be able to participate as well. And some may participate later.
And everything else, yeah.
So
chat's usually pretty fun too with all the online folks,
right?
And just plant the suggestion that they're going to like the next talk too, real well.
There you go. There you go.
Steven, are you going to have copies of your new book available?
Yeah, I will probably try my best to anyway, but okay. That is the plan right now.
Cool.
Okay. Well, guys, I want to thank you for being a part of this tonight and for being a part of Strange Realities. Please, everybody, tell us where people can find you, and all that, and anything that you want to that you would like to promote. And Cheslin, we will start with you.
Oh, okay. You can find, if you want more, if you want to like know my hypnotherapy style, you can find me on my YouTube channel. It's called Vance Hypnotherapy on YouTube. It's I'm still growing it. Like I'm still like creating videos and like posting new things. So it's getting better as time goes on. And then if you would like to do a session with me, you can email me. You'll find my email like under the descriptions and like in my bio on YouTube. You can also contact me on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook very often, so probably email is better. And then we can do like a hypnotherapy session, or we could like, you know, talk about like hypnotherapy and like any questions you might have.
Okay. Excellent. Brent.
Okay. Well, my Alternate Perceptions magazine comes out monthly, the first of each month, and it's also archived. So you go to the top of the page and look at back issues, but it's, available at apmagazine.info. And I'm also on Facebook, Brent Rains, and then also an Alternate Perceptions page also for people who want to read the weirder stuff. And, Chris, I've got three books on Amazon. My first, Visitors from Hidden Realms in 2004, and On the Edge of Reality, 2009. And then, of course, my John A. Keel, The Man, the Myth, the Ongoing Mysteries from 2019.
Okay, and John, that is a great book on John Keel, and there is an interview with us interviewing you about it, and Soraya on Where the Road Go has talked to you about it several times. So, and Mr. Recluse.
Well, I am the host of the Farm Podcast. You can generally find that in all good Google searches under the Farm Podcast Mach 2. I for that second part there. It's always on Apple and Spotify and most of the other major podcast providers. Also, you can find me on Patreon. That would be patreon.com/the Farm Podcast II. So, yeah, if you sign up there for either the basic program, the all-access one on the lower tier, you get two additional full-length shows per month, which is 3 or 4 hours of bonus material. And for all-access patrons, you get that, plus the Zoom parties, my dispatches from all the weird places I travel to across the country, a lot of my geopolitical musings on the State of the Union, and all kinds of other goodies. And also, I'm the author of three books, all of which are available on Amazon. The first is one that I co-wrote with Frank Zero. That would be Strange Tales of the Parapolitical. And then the two that I did by myself, A Special Relationship, Trump, Epstein, and the Secret History of the Anglo-American Establishment, Book 1. And then the most recent one that I was just discussing, which is called The Art, The Secret History of Cy-War, Conspiratainment, and the Shattering Reality, Book 1. And you can also get PDF and KDP versions of this at the Farm's official store, which is the farmpodcast.store. Again, that's all one word, the farmpodcast.store. So there you go.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. And I want to thank all you guys for being part of this and being a part of Strange Realities. Serviel, is there anything that you want to add before we sign off here?
We saw some tickets come through on the live stream here. We appreciate that, folks. The more tickets that can be purchased in advance, which we understand they'll be mostly just the online folks by now, if you haven't planned that weekend, that will help us. The more we get will help us to cover the costs and stuff that we have to pay up front for this. It's definitely a labor of love, and we compensate all of our speakers every time. But StrangeRealitiesConference.com, if you don't have tickets yet, get them as soon as possible, please, and we'll get you in the groups. It also helps if you do this in advance so that we can get you in the streaming groups or whichever method you prefer ahead of time instead of us having to kind of scramble while we're in the physical location trying to get the streams and everything ready. So that'll really help. If you want to go to StrangeRealitiesConference.com right now.
Absolutely. Can't iterate that enough. And keep in mind, this entire stream, the entire conference from Friday evening till the end of Sunday is being streamed. It's just that on Sunday, November 5th, that is just online only. So we will not be at the venue, but the entire thing is being streamed. So guys, going forward in the next couple of weeks, next week on the 17th, we will be streaming live with Aaron Gullius, Chris Ertz, David Metcalf, and Zach Hunt. And on the 24th, Soraya Askath, Timothy Renner, and Michael Hughes will also be streaming with us. And we will have two more of these previews before we say adios to go to Strange Realities. So guys, looking forward to it, and get your tickets at strangerealitiesconference.com. All right guys, thank you guys very much, and we'll talk to you soon. Spirit on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.